From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On the program today, we talk with a legislator who wants a law that drivers' electronic devices in the car must be hands-free. Plus, our political commentators talk about Lansing legislating local.
Politicians are sort of guilty of saying, I'm for local control, except when I'm against local control.
We talk with a historian about Holland's Tulip Time Festival.
It's always been a mixture of authenticity and kitsch. It's authentic, it's contrived, it's Dutch, and it's American.
We'll hear about fighting infant mortality in Michigan.
Really bringing together all of the different areas that may affect a mother getting that care that she needs so that she can have a healthy pregnancy.
And our artisan of Michigan this time is Gabriel Pavola, a bladesmith.
Well, I'm a Finnish Hooper, and I grew up with those types of knives.
All of that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan's Republican state lawmakers want to block so-called sanctuary city policies. Senate Republicans have written a provision into the budget for the state corrections department. It punishes counties with policies that limit law enforcement from cooperating fully with federal officials on immigration issues. The penalty? Counties would lose a jail reimbursement, and it can add up to some pretty big money. A state Senate subcommittee passed its version of the corrections budget Wednesday. Now, 2 years ago, Wayne County Sheriff Benny Napoleon directed his staff not to honor U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement detainer requests unless specific conditions are met. Sheriff Napoleon joins us now. Welcome back.
Hey, how are you?
Just fine. Hey, how did you, why did you issue that order 2 years ago?
Well, the fact is that a detainer is not a warrant. When people are remanded to the Wayne County Jail, they get there by one way. And that is by the order of a judge. They get out three ways. They either serve their time, they bond out, or they're released by a judge. If any one of those three conditions are met, I am obligated to release them, or else I am false imprisoning them. So a detainer from ICE that says, hold this person till we come pick them up, is not a valid warrant. Once people meet one of those three conditions, I'm obligated to release them. What we do is when we have a prisoner who is admitted to the jail, that may be of interest to ICE, we notify them. We tell them when that person is scheduled to be released, and if they want to pick them up, they have plenty of time to make arrangements to pick them up at the date and time that we're going to release them. So I don't understand why this whole issue becomes a problem.
In the last couple of years, how would you characterize the relationship between your department and local ICE officers?
It's fine, and I still think it's fine. It's just that we open the county up to liability legally that says that when a person is scheduled to be released and they've served one of those three conditions that I described, I am obligated to release them. We notify ICE that they're going to be released as soon as we know that release date and time is up. If they want them, they have plenty of time to come get them. So I don't even understand why this is an issue. They are aware that a ICE detainer is not a warrant issued by a independent, neutral and detached magistrate, which is a requirement for a person to be confined to the Wayne County Jail.
What do you feel this budget provision that's been proposed is saying to Wayne County and, for that matter, other counties, which won't always give full cooperation to federal immigration authorities?
I think that description is grossly exaggerated. We are cooperative. I don't know what else we could do other than violate the constitutional rights of people who are scheduled to be released from the jail. We do everything we can to cooperate with ICE. So to suggest that we aren't cooperating is totally not true.
Now, of course, some people in the legislature don't see it that way. Republican State Senator Tom Barrett chairs the budget subcommittee. He says it is a good thing to work with ICE in any way possible, and the Department of Homeland Security should fully cooperate with their efforts and requests to deport immigrants suspected of entering this country illegally.
Well, we can't fully cooperate with them if they're violating the law and they're violating the rights of folks until a court tells us that we are legally within our rights to hold people under those conditions. And no court has said that. And to my knowledge, every court that has looked at the issue says that we are obligated to release them once those conditions are met. So until the court tells us, police are not allowed to issue warrants. We request warrants. We present information, and warrants are issued by judges who are neutral and detached and have no vested interest in the outcome of the case at that point in time. When someone of that authority tells us that we should do something different, we will do it.
How much money are we talking about if this proposal goes through? How much Wayne County jail money will be lost if this happens?
My understanding, it's about $1.5 million.
What would that mean to your jail operations?
Certainly, it does impact jail operations, but it costs us a lot more money if we decide to hold people against their constitutional right.
Do you think there's a balance here, an alternative here, or some way you can compromise with the state legislature if this goes through, or before this goes through?
We've done everything that I think is reasonable. If a person is admitted to the Wayne, is remanded to the Wayne County Jail, and we notify ICE that that person is there, we tell them when, what time, what day this person is going to be released. If you want them, this is what time and what date you should be there to pick them up. I don't see how that is unreasonable. I don't see how that is not cooperating, saying it's like if you wanted to pick somebody up and I tell you they're going to be released Friday at 4 o'clock, next Friday at 4 o'clock p.m. If you're really interested in having that person that you want to pick them up, you would be there next Friday at 4 o'clock p.m. It would be a totally different story if the person was remanded to the jail and you called me and say, hey, when is this guy going to be released, or hold him until I get there and I give you no information. That's not what's happening. We are advising them when we're going to release people, what time and where, and you can come get them. So you describe to me why that is not cooperating.
That is Wayne County Sheriff Benny Napoleon. Thanks for taking the time.
Yes, sir.
Stateside requested an interview with Senator Tom Barrett. His office declined to make him available. State Senator Ruth Johnson, the former Secretary of State, wants to stop people from using cell phones, tablets, and other devices while driving unless they're in hands-free mode. Senator Johnson joins us now. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been working with your sheriff, Michael Bouchard, in Oakland County on this proposal. What's the concern?
Well, the concern is right now it's really an epidemic of people that are using electronic devices while they're holding them and getting in crashes, and it's distracted driving. It's resulting in 72 fatalities just in 2017 and over 20,000 crashes. And that number is growing every day. When you look down just for 4.5 seconds, it can be the length of a football field to use your electronic device. So we already have a law that says that you're not supposed to be texting and driving, but there's no way to tell whether somebody's using a Google map or something. So you'll have to use your Bluetooth, or for those that don't have Bluetooth, we do have a backup where they're able to mount their telephone on their dashboard, long as it doesn't interfere with what they're looking at out through their windshield.
Okay, so it's a matter of you can't be holding it one hand and typing on it or moving icons with another hand. It's a matter of making sure at least one hand's on the steering wheel, right?
Yes, well, you can only touch your phone to get it going. Cell phones now, you can talk into them, so you use the Bluetooth off your phone. So you will not be typing on your cell phone at all with this law.
So drivers under the age of 18 would not be allowed to use a mobile phone at all while driving. Why is that?
Well, of course, when you're young and inexperienced, that's when you have the most problems, especially balancing and multitasking. And it is the largest killer of age 16 to 24-year-olds in this country, and that's driving, and the accidents are generally from distracted driving.
Making phone calls, I assume receiving and making them, would still be allowed while driving, even if it's a handheld phone. Why is using the phone different from any other use of the of a device like that?
You will not be allowed to hold your phone in your hand. You will have to mount it on your dashboard, or you can use a lot of people have hands-free systems built right into their car. But we wanted to make sure those that didn't would be able to follow the law and use a phone, but they must do it hands-free. So, you know, the National Safety Council says at least 9 Americans die and 100 are injured in distracted driving crashes every single day in this country. And it's estimated that nearly 1 in 4 car accidents are caused by texting and driving. And this isn't just about texting. I mean, we've seen people FaceTiming in their car, playing games in their car on their phone. Evidently, people don't know how much it puts them and others at risk. So it will be a law that will require that you not hold on to your phone, you not play games, you not do FaceTime, don't text, But you may talk as long as it's hands-free.
What kind of penalties would there be for using electronic devices that are not hands-free?
If you're using electronic devices, we've made the first time that you get caught no points, but it is $125. But then if you get caught subsequently, you will get points on your driver's license. We want to make sure everybody has time to realize and know, but it's urgent, really, that people know how dangerous this is. And, you know, I hear people say, oh, I can do that and drive. It's not a problem. It is a problem when you look at the statistics and when you meet the family members of those that have passed away because of accidents that were needless. Drivers who use handheld devices are 4 times more likely to get in a serious crash to cause serious injury. You know, probably the majority of us have done it at some point, but I'm not sure everyone realizes the hazards and how many more people are dying and getting in accidents that really cause a lot of physical pain and also long-term injuries.
What kind of support are you getting among your colleagues in the legislature?
Well, I started this bill 18 years ago, and I didn't get very much, to tell you the truth. But I think the time has come, and people realize that. And the legislation now is supported by the Michigan Chiefs of Police, the Michigan Sheriff's Association, the Michigan Auto Law, Ford Motor Company, General Motors. It's got a lot of support because I think people just look at the statistical information, and once you meet a couple parents that have lost their kids needlessly because of this, it's not really hard to make a good decision on it to support it.
Ruth Johnson, Michigan's former Secretary of State, now a Republican state senator from Holly. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much, and please remember, do not text and drive.
Coming up, visitors to Holland, Michigan this weekend will get to see hundreds of thousands of tulips in bloom. The city is celebrating the 90th annual Tulip Time Festival.
It's always been a mixture of authenticity and kitsch. It's authentic, it's contrived, it's Dutch, and it's American.
In 10 minutes, we'll hear how tulips came to be a symbol of the city's Dutch heritage. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Nearly 7 of every 1,000 babies born in Michigan won't make it past their first birthday. And when you break that down by statistics and race, the picture becomes even grimmer. African American and Native American babies die at rates nearly double the state average and more than triple the rate of white babies. Late last year, the state unveiled a new plan to tackle infant mortality. It's called the Mother-Infant Health and Equity Improvement Plan. Nina Sassy is the woman leading the implementation of the state's new plan. She oversees it as the state's senior maternal health strategist, and she joins us now. Nina, welcome to Stateside.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I understand access to health care is a major factor for expectant mothers. Why is that the case?
I mean, if you think about Michigan in general, when you think about access to health care for UP, that's going to mean something totally different than what it means for a metropolitan area like Grand Rapids or Detroit. But when we talk about access, we're really just talking about getting women to their appointments when they're pregnant so that they can get the proper treatment, so that they can have, you know, a healthy pregnancy as well as a healthy birth for their child.
How will this effort address the racial disparities in infant mortality I was describing earlier?
So with this particular plan, I kind of want to give you an overview of the Mother Infant Health and Equity Improvement Plan. For one, this plan is different than the previous plans. The previous infant mortality reduction plan just focused on infant mortality, whereas with this particular plan, we're making sure that it has a maternal and infant focus because we know that in order to have a healthy baby, you need a healthy mom. And so one of the key ways that we're doing this is with our vision. We're saying zero disparity, zero preventable death. And we plan to have our public health partners and clinicians and community leaders address the disparities by just making sure that they are meeting families where they are, that they're, you know, offering services and just understanding that every community has different circumstances.
You have a personal connection to this issue. What is that?
So this work is very personal to me. Before having my son, who's now 5 years old, I actually had a stillbirth due to my cervix opening. And when I became pregnant with my child, Isaac, my cervix began to open. And he was actually born 2 pounds, 4 ounces at 32 weeks. But the reason, you know, I share this story is because as a public health, you know, professional, I've been in public health for about 15 years now. There were things that I felt like could have been improved. You know, I felt like my voice wasn't heard. And again, this is just coming from my personal story, but I requested a cervical length check 2 or 3 times with my son Isaac, and 2 times they were rejected. It wasn't until the last time. I was very fortunate that my father-in-law is an OBGYN, and he finally wrote a letter and said that as an African-American woman, cervical length, that's something that should be checked, especially with my prior history. And because of that, I feel like my son is now here. You know, when we talk about disparities and we talk about health equity, you know, I wanted to have that personal touch and know that it affects us. And it's not just a socioeconomic thing, unfortunately. It's more about just making sure that, you know, when we speak to our providers that we have the information that we need, but also as a provider that any implicit bias that we may have, making sure we check that at the door and just making sure that everyone has, you know, access to equitable health.
What kind of groups and organizations and who's got the transportation and other things that these expectant mothers are going to need?
Well, the way that we're structuring this, for one, we have our maternal infant strategy group, and that's comprised of like the leaders in health, and they're really the group that help kind of guiding this plan and making sure that it has the proper strategic focus. Then we have our regional perinatal collaborative, and that's really where the work is being done. So some of them have begun to work with transportation, but that's where they're really working with those different sectors that may not traditionally work with health to make sure that mothers have access and have those needs. So what we're hoping is that, you know, the collaboratives will be able to partner more with, you know, housing and transportation and get them more engaged at the table. And it starts with just recognizing that they have to be there, reaching out to them, getting their input in and seeing where a bus line is, for example, but really getting them to the table and starting the conversation.
A significant cause of infant deaths is accidentally suffocating the baby, sleeping alongside a parent or a caregiver, or putting the baby in the crib the wrong way. That means more people than just the parents have to be educated. How difficult is that challenge?
It's a very difficult challenge. It takes a village to raise a kid. And again, like you just mentioned, it's not just the mom and dad that are caring for that child. You know, one of the initiatives that started from the Mother Infant Health and Equity Improvement Plan is our ambassador program. And what I love about this program is that it's not just a program, again, for just moms and fathers. We have grandparents and aunts and uncles and anyone that, you know, is part of that village for that family. They can participate in this ambassador program. And they're learning about, you know, safe sleep and breastfeeding and different strategies that can improve the overall health of mothers and babies. It's a great way for them to learn, but also to give that feedback. For example, we've had a meeting where we've talked about, you know, breastfeeding and, you know, what were some of the challenges? What were some of the things that you all struggled with? And what can we do better as a health department to make sure that you have access to the information that you need, you know, and the materials that you need so that you can, you know, actually implement that intervention. The same is true with safe sleep. So just making sure that everyone understands, you know, the safe sleep practices, everyone has those tools and that they're sharing it. They're ambassadors within their community. They're making sure that, you know, the infants in their neighborhood or their community, that they're safe. So that's, again, one of the initiatives that we're pushing out through this improvement plan.
Obviously, the baby is not the only person at risk. Mothers are at risk during pregnancy, during delivery. What's being done to help them?
So one of the major initiatives that we're pushing out, or has been out for a while, is the MyAIM safety bundles. And so with these bundles, hospitals would implement them, and And basically the two major bundles that we have in Michigan are the hemorrhage and hypertension bundles. Just making sure that with the hemorrhage that they quantify blood loss and give a proper treatment. With hypertension, just making sure that they monitor blood pressure and give and follow the protocol just to make sure that they are able to maintain a healthy blood pressure for that mom.
Is this an effort that we can see an almost immediate improvement? Well, I mean, will we see a lower infant mortality rate yet this year?
Well, unfortunately, that's not how infant and mortality rates work. So it takes a year or two to see some drop in the rate itself. But what we will see is just, for instance, if you think on a smaller scale, if you think about safe sleep and how that relates to infant mortality, the more you're spreading the word and people know about safe sleep practices and the more they have the tools, like the more that they have those bassinets or play pins, the more that you're preventing a death. So you may not see a decrease in the overall infant mortality rate, but that's one less baby dying in that particular region. Every intervention that we roll out, the more people are aware of from a public standpoint, the more that providers and communities are working together, you're going to see that effect, just saving, you know, one baby, one mom at a time.
Nina Sassy is Senior Maternal Child Health Strategist for the State of Michigan's Mother, Infant, Health, and Equity Improvement Plan. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
The 90th annual Tulip Time Festival starts in Holland tomorrow. According to a Holland Sentinel report, a lot of tulips are up, plenty of color, and the tulips will peak in the middle of next week. Joining us now is Bob Swieringa. He's a research professor at Hope College and a specialist in Dutch immigration history. He wrote a 3-volume history titled Holland, Michigan, From Dutch Colony to Dynamic City. So why are tulips important to the Holland Festival and its history?
Why tulips? It's the national flower of the Netherlands, the national symbol for hundreds of years. And the Netherlands is the flower shop of the world. So why wouldn't Holland, Michigan have tulips when in 1928, a school teacher talked about the need to beautify the city. And she convinced the mayor to order tulips from the Netherlands and plant them. And that happened in 1930. The suggestion was made, and there was a small festival in 29, but in 30, we had 100,000 tulips and about 100,000 visitors. And the next year, we had 150,000 visitors, and we're up to 1 million tulip bulbs. And by 1934, you had 3 million tulips, and today there's 5 million.
Wow. I've read about the Dutch tulip mania. Can you give us a brief history of how tulips came to be so valued in 16th century Netherlands?
The first tulips were imported into the Netherlands in the 1550s. And within the next decades, tulip mania developed to the point where people would pay more for a special tulip variety than they would for a home. But the whole thing crashed.
Famously crashed.
Yeah, famous crash. The tulip mania, it's called, and the tulip craze. Prices did come down to our reasonable levels, but the Keukenhof flower garden in the Netherlands is the world famous place to see tulips, and they said it's their national symbol. So for over 450 years, tulip and the Netherlands has been synonymous. But they actually came originally from the Ottoman Empire, from Turkey.
Tell me why Western Michigan has become a popular site for Dutch immigration.
It was chosen in 1847 by a minister who led the first group of seceders from the state church in the 1840s. And he chose Michigan. Actually, he was on his way to Wisconsin, but Michigan boosters in Detroit convinced him to consider West Michigan. And he found the Black River here area, now Lake Makatawa, was still uninhabited by whites. There was an Indian tribe here under Chief Wakazoo, the Odawa tribe. But there were settlements at Grand Haven, the county seat, and at Allegan on the Kalamazoo River, Grand Haven on the Grand River. But the Holland area was still ready for settlement. And so Fenralty, this dominie, decided to settle here. And he was the magnet that drew other immigrants. By 1850, you had over 3,000 Dutch immigrants settling in villages all around Holland. We now have an 11-city bicycle tour through these colonies modeled after the Elf Sladentalk, the ice skating race in the Netherlands that happens when they get ice through the cities of Friesland.
For people who've never visited Holland during tulip time, describe what they might see.
Well, there's all kinds of carnival events and booths where they can buy elf and ears and cotton candy and so on. But they'll also see some genuine Dutch activities. The wooden shoe carver making wooden shoes, which the wooden shoe dancers wear. The music is authentic. The costumes are authentic. There's Dutch foods available besides elf and ears, like Erwten soup, pea soup, which is a classic Dutch soup. And there's increasingly attempts to make it more authentic. But it's always been a mixture of authenticity and kitsch. It's authentic, it's contrived, it's Dutch, and it's American.
Tell us about this thing I keep hearing about, the street scrubbing.
That started the second year. You know, the Dutch are known for their cleanliness, so that they decided, let's bring out the Dutch cleanser and have, you know, pails of water on the street, and let's clean the street. So the mayor was asked to come out with white gloves and put his hands on the street and then declare that the street is dirty and needs to be scrubbed. Dutch housewives always scrubbed their stoops, their porches, and this was just a tradition in the Netherlands to clean the street in front of your house. But the first year they used the soap, and that left a residue that made it very difficult on the klompen dancers. So after that, it was always just plain water. The mayor always comes on Wednesday for the folks parade and wields the broom. The Dutch dancers, by the way, are all women. There's hundreds of them. They're teenage girls and women, and half dressed as boys and half are dressed as girls because they have to they dance in pairs.
The 90th annual Tulip Time Festival starts in Holland tomorrow. Professor Swearinger, thanks very much for telling us about it.
Yep, everybody is Dutch this week in Holland.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yemen's coffee-growing traditions date back centuries. Well, now they're seeing a revival in the States, thanks in part to a coffee shop in Dearborn. It's called Kawa House, and people from around the world flock there to sample the unique coffee. And while patrons sip on drinks spiced with cardamom and ginger, the owner hopes to show that there's a lot more to Yemen than just war and poverty. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia paid a visit and brought back this audio postcard.
My name is Ibrahim Al-Hasabani. I'm the founder of Kawa House. I'm from Yemen, Sana'a. Yemen is the birthplace for coffee. That's why it's come. People now, they're trying to come and try the Yemeni coffee beans because they want to see what's different between Yemeni coffee and the other coffee. Every coffee has different flavor on it. So Yemeni coffee always has natural sweetness on it. Some of them, they have like milky chocolate. Some of them like a fruity mango. From farm to farm, it's give you a different taste. We have Yemeni latte. This is one of the best drinks. Latte is, it's not Yemeni style. But I add the spice on it, like ginger, cinnamon, cardamom, and it give you a different taste, different flavor. That's why I call it Yemeni latte, because you use Yemeni style. Of course, we use Yemeni beans on it, and we add the Yemeni spice on it. Also, we have Jubani. Jubani is one of the really different style of coffee because it gives you different taste, different flavor, because it's mixed between medium roast, light roast, and the coffee husk, and ginger, cinnamon, cardamom too. When you drink it, you think you drink like something between tea and coffee, but it's a coffee. Also, we have the Adani chai. Adani chai is one of the most seller here for people that don't drink coffee. It's black tea with the cardamom, nutmeg, and milk. We add milk on it. I think it's a number one seller. I think it's mean a lot for the community to open special coffee shop here, especially from Yemen, because the Yemeni community now is growing. It's not just about coffee only. It's about story. About, we tell people our story about what's going on in Yemen. We really have a lot of things good over there, but we want to show it. This is the way how we want to show it. This is the way how we talk to the people from every culture, from everywhere, face to face. I have people that come from everywhere and around the country, around USA. Also, they come from out of the state, actually. I have people that come from Germany, from Italy, from Emirates, from Dubai, from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt, from Spain, from London. They hear about the place and they come. They first come when they come to Michigan, they said, we drive from the airport and they come to your coffee shop. This one is making me really happy because I know what I did. I did something good and I'm proud of it. I'm proud to be a part of this community, to bring new people to Dearborn, to bring new people. They're looking for new experience. They want to know about coffee. They want to know about Yemeni coffee. They want to know about a story about Yemen.
That was produced by Mercedes Mejia. Next, the Republican-led Michigan legislature is taking up more bills that would limit the decisions local communities can make on their own.
It's inconsistent from a political kind of philosophy standpoint.
Our Friday political commentators break down why the party of local control wants more statewide rules for municipalities emanating from Lansing. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Every few weeks, I hit the road looking for people who are making useful things by hand. We call the series Artisans of Michigan. This time, we visit the Delano Homestead at the Kalamazoo Nature Center. That's the sound of a blacksmith pumping the bellows to make sure the fire in the forge is hot. We're at the Nature Center because there's a small shed where a volunteer shows visitors how a homestead blacksmith shop might work. But he's better known for what he forges. His name is Gabriel Pavlov.
Good Finnish name.
What do you make?
I make knives, pukos and lukus, or liukus. I've seen two different ways to pronounce it. So.
All right, you're going to explain those.
Okay. Puko is a traditional Finnish knife. And it's your basic everyday carry knife. It's used for anything from dispatching deer to fish. You can even use them to make kindling for starting fires. And then a luku is a bigger version. It's used more in lieu of an axe, but it can also do the very same thing that you need from a knife rather than an axe.
Why those kinds of knives?
Well, I'm a Finnish Uper. And I grew up with those types of knives. In recent years, they became really popular with the bushcraft community because they are so light to carry and you can use them for a lot of different things. I mean, they're your original multi-purpose tool and knife, and it stood the test of time for centuries in the cold north. So those, for me, I'm kind of reconnecting with ancestral roots, but they just make sense to me rather than buying all the bells and whistles you get from your Rambo type knives or whatever.
You're saying you're trying to connect with your ancestral roots, and a lot of people, you know, say they're Scottish will buy a kilt rather than make a kilt. Why aren't you just buying the knives instead of making them?
Sisu.
All right, let me jump in here for a moment. According to Finlandia University in Hancock, Michigan, for the Finnish people, sisu has a mystical, almost magical meaning. It is a Finnish term that can be roughly translated into English as a strength of will, determination, perseverance, and acting rationally in the face of adversity. Sisu is not momentary courage, but the ability to sustain that courage. It stands for the philosophy that what must be done will be done, regardless of cost. So keep that in mind as we talk to Pavlo.
I'm really stubborn. You know, I started learning blacksmithing about 22 years ago now. I took my first class at Northern Michigan University. I was always fascinated with the blade, with the sword. It's a tool that you really can't improve upon. It just does the job that you need done. And so I went off, learned swordsmithing, and then, that experience really kind of left me walking away from bladesmithing. I just didn't want to do it because, a lot of factors. But do your research on who you learn from, because often if it seems too good to be true, it is.
It wasn't until about 8 years ago that he started getting back into bladesmithing. He just could not shake it.
I believe, and I believe this to my core, is that we all have a gift. We all have something we do, and we may not be the best at it, but it's what inspires us to be the best we can. If we can use that ability, that gift, to try and improve the lives of those around us, do that thing. I don't advise anyone being crazy enough to try and pick up bladesmithing, because it's a huge investment. The saying of, to make $1 million in bladesmithing, you got to start with $2 million, is quite true.
I've heard that about other professions as well.
Yeah, well, this is no different. Depending on how you scale up or scale down, it's going to cost you either time or money, or all of both. But whatever it is, whatever is your passion, you got to do it.
By the way, because of a show called Forged in Fire on the History Channel, bladesmithing has become a lot more popular. The show is in its sixth season. Pavla says there's no concern yet about competition. There are so many different people who want a custom blade. He's sold to musicians, foresters, sculptors, school teachers, hunters, and more. Pavla uses steel he salvages from things such as old farm equipment or even steel cable. He could use steel stock instead, and it actually would be easier in the long run.
The one factor you don't want when you're starting out is, was this a reclaimed steel? Because there could be stress fractures already put into it just from when it was used. I probably lose about every fourth or fifth blade I pound out with reclaimed steel because of those stress fractures. Of course, my human stupidity comes into play sometimes. But most of the time, it's because there was already some stresses in the steel. And you can see it if you're paying attention. Sometimes I'm rushing, don't even pay attention, and it shows up later. But really, if you're going to get into
this... Well, with that risk, though, why do it? I mean, if you're losing one out of every five blades, why use our upcycle steel?
There's a story to it. There's a history to it.
That history has to do with the origin of iron. He says as the universe formed and stars exploded, iron was a basic element in our Earth. The poetry of iron in those celestial forges is something he keeps in mind. It took billions of years before that iron made its way to his forge. There's a lesson in patience there.
If you come to the forge with a bad attitude, with a lot of anger and frustration, all you're going to do is make a hunk of junk. You really have to, I can't believe I'm going to use these metaphors, but you got to purify yourself with the fire, focus on what you're doing. Every strike is not haphazard. It's all thought out and coordinated. A lot of people see the hammer, an anvil, and they don't realize it's a process of pinching. No different than using Play-Doh. The reason why you use the anvil and hammer, obviously, is to not burn yourself and to still provide some force behind it. But it moves the same way. You have to make it a kind of meditation. At least that's my process. I'm sure there are guys out there who just, Hulk smash and make really amazing stuff. But from any of the master smiths that I've seen, they come at it with a good attitude, a good mind, a good heart, even when it's a bad day. And they just use the process to get rid of all that angst and create really amazing stuff.
Tell me about the handles, because you've got some beautiful handles.
Still trying. thank you. Well, being a Michiganian, and I will not say Michigander, there's one thing we have a lot of here. It's a lot of natural resources. I'd rather try and showcase what we have around here. I mean, we have antler, we have plenty of wood, and you just gotta know when to let it speak for itself. And you gotta just go out there and harvest. And that's, I mean, that's the whole reason why I do this. If I can make a knife that makes someone feel empowered enough to go out and brave the wilderness and wild on their own, they might find out what's really amazing and special about this area.
Gabriel Pavla with Ragged Raven Forge is our latest Artisan of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. This week, there were a couple of stories out of Lansing that showed the Republican-led state legislature wants to restrict what local governments can do. Here to talk about that are our political commentators for this week. Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican Majority Leader in the Michigan State Senate. And T.J. Buchholz, President of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm in Lansing. So this first story is about state legislators looking at banning local governments from using zoning laws to stop short-term rentals at homes, such as Airbnb. Local officials don't like that idea at all. They say this can turn into problems for the neighbors if they don't have control over it. Others say local government should not be able to stop you from renting out a couple of rooms in your house. Ken, should this be up to local officials or controlled by on high by state officials?
Well, this is another example where I think politicians are sort of guilty of saying, I'm for local control, except when I'm against local control. And I think Republicans historically have been probably particularly guilty of this. You know, the issue here is, as they would frame it, a property right issue. And then on the other side, which is local government and other interests like hotel and restaurants, that it's, well, it's the ability of local government to, you know, determine the character of a given neighborhood, and we use zoning to do that. And, you know, it's quite controversial. I don't think they've resolved it yet. There'll probably be some compromise in the works at some point. But it is kind of the general theme that I see is, once again, you know, I'm kind of for local control except when I'm against it.
TJ, zoning laws make sure that uses are appropriate for a particular area. Should local officials be restricted by the state?
You know, I think this is a very interesting issue in that, you know, when we look at the challenges of the rentals, when you buy a home, let's say on Lake Michigan, you expect to have some quiet, you expect to have a certain lifestyle, but then when the home right next door to you turns into a hotel, it is problematic. And you know, certainly the zoning sometimes doesn't have the sort of same wherewithal that it normally would. Again, you know, you have here in Lansing, you do have, you know, a lot of, you know, local government organizations coming out, you know, unhappy with this issue. You know, and we've done some work as a company, you know, on this issue purposely, because at the end of the day, you have, you know, residents who bought a home for one reason, and then next door there's an actual hotel, and that wasn't in certainly the spirit of the zoning law. So I do think there is going to be a compromise here, but again, it's a slippery slope. How much control should local government have? You know, this is an issue that projects beyond short-term rental. It talks about, you know, how zoning works across Michigan.
The other story is about whether Michigan communities which don't fully cooperate with federal immigration officers should see their jail funds cut by the state. Ken, what are the considerations if the state penalizes so-called sanctuary cities by withholding money for jails? I mean, you've got that situation in your county. It might be affected by this.
Well, here's a case where I think politicians at both the local and the state level just kind of can't resist the temptation to get involved in the issue of immigration, which is largely a federal matter. Republicans actually, although they might appear sort of united on this, are kind of motivated by two really different impulses. You know, one is, you know, some Republicans see sanctuary cities as a direct attack on Trump, but there are others that, you know, are kind of motivated more by the sense that, look, if this is federal law and federal law being enforced, whether you like it or not, you ought to cooperate with it. And so you shouldn't, you know, locals shouldn't be allowed to have or set up these so-called sanctuary cities. So, you know, the issue here is state government, or in this case, Senate Appropriations Committee and the Republican Senate, trying to put leverage on local governments by saying, if you're a sanctuary city, we're not going to give you, you know, some of these reimbursements for housing felons in county jails. But I do think the policy is sort of, you know, you're cutting your nose off to spite your face, because if you do that, it's going to cost state taxpayers more by putting them in state prisons.
Right, and that's what the Department of Corrections has been saying. TJ, what do you make of these penalties against municipalities that don't fully cooperate with immigration officers?
Well, I think the majority here, you know, in Lansing is trying to politicize an issue that shouldn't necessarily be politicized. You know, I think that there's a lot of distrust, you know, of the federal government, you know, with ICE and with the work that it does. And I think we've seen, you know, when Kent County is an example, you know, I think a county who in the past has cooperated with ICE officials, but, you know, making those individuals have a real challenge with the local law enforcement. It's a real problem. And again, I think at the end of the day, requires cooperation between the federal government and local government, and state government just can't seem to help itself on this issue, I think for more political reasons than actual policy ones, for sure.
Well, let's talk about this larger issue that Ken was alluding to. You know, the Republican ethos of keeping big government out of people's lives, keeping decisions at the local level. Why does it seem that we have this trend of going in the opposite direction, Ken?
Well, it's not unique to the, you know, sort of the modern era. I mean, this has happened, I think, historically, where, you know, and I'll speak on sort of on the Republican side, is, you know, we like to preach the notion of local control and push government down to its lowest level, federal, state, local, but then issues arise where you kind of don't like what the locals do, whether it's establishing a minimum wage or, you know, in this case, you know, zoning out short-term rentals, and there's myriad other examples.
Yeah, ban on plastic bags, all that kind
of
stuff.
Well, it's just, you know, it's inconsistent from a political kind of philosophy standpoint. But a famous philosopher once said that consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. So this isn't unique to the modern era.
TJ, what do you think of this sort of incongruency?
Well, certainly, I think everyone wants local government to have local control. And again, I think when we look at residents, most of the governance that impacts them directly, you know, their local roads, their trash pickup, their police and fire services happens at a local level. But there are certain things that the state and federal government want some control over, that want some say in terms of how we operate as a society. And I think, as Ken said, this is not a new thing. This is always a space on the spectrum, which is where do we need to be to affect positive change? And, you know, I just would prefer not to see these kinds of issues politicized and focus more on how do we positively impact taxpayers. I think that's the bottom line at local government. How do we work positively in the best interest of residents without being political?
In this era of partisan divide, I'm not sure how you ever get to that point for now. TJ Bokowitz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs. Ken Sikkema is with Public Sector Consultants, a former Republican majority leader in the Michigan State Senate. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Lester.
You too. Thank you, Lester.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock, who said he was just going to shut up today, so I wouldn't have anything to say about him. He's hilarious. There's always something to say about Rusty. Just ask Patty and Kevin. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and Sarah Leeson. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.